KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next on Positively Revolting, Ani speaks to author Dar Jamal about climate change and takes your calls. At 9, Veterans Voice Radio deals with matters of war and peace, health issues, and the after effect of war. At 10, Valley Views looks at how the two-party political system thrives while freedom of choice dies. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Radio Zine host Ken Joan talks to the authors of Formosa Moon, which is the story of their move from Portland to Taiwan. And finally, at 11:30, Making Contact explores safe, at-home abortion options and the growing movement for self-managed abortions. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Cotton Cloud Natural Beds and Furniture, women-owned since 1981. Providing sustainable wood furniture, locally handcrafted futons, latex mattresses, and more, using organic and natural materials. The Cotton Cloud showroom is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland, online at cottoncloudfutons.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional old time Appalachian style string band musicians. There will be jam sessions, a Cajun honky tonk night, concerts, dances, workshops, and performances. Again, that's the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. Location and age restrictions vary. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 21st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen King, a filmed record, from Montgomery to Memphis, a historic documentary nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar in 1971. The screen benefits the Children's Book Bank. Again, that's King, a film record, showing Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio connection. This is Positively Revolting, and I'm your host, Ani. This morning, I have the honor of talking with Dar Jamal. Dar is an independent investigative journalist. His work has been published in many, many papers and outlets, websites like Truth Out, the Interpress Service, Tom Dispatch, The Sunday Herald in Scotland, The Guardian, Le Monde Diplomatique, Huffington Post, The Nation, Al Jazeera, The Independent, and many others. Dar's reporting has earned him numerous awards, including the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism and five Project Censored Awards. His previous books include Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. They focus on the U.S.'s wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he's currently focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption. His new book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, came out this week from the New Press. Dar Jamal, thank you so much for being with us on Positively Revolting this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I just want to sort of jump straight into this. There's so much to cover this morning. We know that climate change or anthropogenic climate disruption is happening. There are still those in power that are putting out the narrative that it's a theory, it's not really something to be concerned about, to ignore the studies that are happening, and in fact to ignore what we can see with our own eyes around us. We know that the World Health Organization estimates the tens of thousands of people every year, perhaps over 100,000 people, are currently dying because of changes with the weather systems, because of catastrophic climate disruption. And by 2030, the World Health Organization says that perhaps as many as 250,000 people will die each year from causes related to climate disruption. But there's a new study out this week that says that that's a very conservative estimate. And that's what we find over and over again when we look at studies around climate disruption. We see the study that seems too horrible to consider or think about being shown to be kind of a best case scenario than the, that things just constantly, the new studies come out to show that things are worse than we thought they were when we thought they were already pretty bad. Can you talk about the fact that every new study seems to say that study that came out last year that scared the bejeebies out of us was really conservative? It's more like this. Can you sort of give a snapshot of the current research and where we're at now with climate disruption?
Well, that's a very important phenomena that you outlined there, and I'm really glad actually that you start with that, because I think it's the necessary context because of how rapidly everything's changing, because so many feedback loops have kicked into the climate system now. But I'll start with just very briefly addressing the first thing that you mentioned of the fact that there's still this basically a federally sponsored and promoted denialism of climate change in this country. It's probably more so here than any other country in the world, although it does happen in other places as well. And here, you know, this has been so well documented by journalists now for quite a few years, how Exxon, even as far back in the 50s, started a campaign. You know, they knew there were going to be deleterious effects of CO2 emissions. And even as far back as then, they started figuring out how to talk about it and not talk about it. And then that essentially evolved into, well, we let's just plant the seed of doubt. You know, it's just we need more studies. And that was the dominant narrative for a long time, to just instill doubt in the general population. And then now watching the Trump administration, them simply walk that back to, okay, well, it's happening, but, you know, we don't know that humans are the cause, or that humans are the primary cause, or how much. I think their current narrative is how much humans are actually responsible for it. Maybe a little bit, but how much, you know? And so they just keep evolving the message. It's also well documented that, you know, these people, their campaigns are grossly funded by the fossil fuel industry. So I think that's the broad brushstrokes there that probably the majority of the listeners already get, but I think it's important to note that. Because in reality, you know, the situation now, it's such a global existential crisis, and it's so massive, and so many other governments around the world are treating it as such So it's just important to note that this country is an anomaly as far as the denialism goes. And then with the studies, how each one seems to get worse and worse. I mean, on the one hand, it's simply because things are getting worse and worse. And so every time someone goes out and studies the Eastern Antarctic and found for a long time, well, there's really no melting or change happening here. This is really going to be the last stronghold where we should see deep impacts from climate change. And then they more recently, the big news that came out the end of last week, or I believe it was possibly even over the weekend, where a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by Eric Wignow of University of California, Irvine, also affiliated with NASA, arguably or subjectively one of the leading, well, certainly one of the leading glaciologists studying the Eastern Antarctic and all of Antarctica. And he said, look, we've seen a six-fold increase in the rate of melting in Antarctica since just the 1970s. So each study gets increasingly alarming because things are unfolding and melting and dying off and changing at that rate. And then the last part of this that is important for people to understand is that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the body that releases every 7 years a global climate assessment, and this is kind of seen as the gold standard around the world of here's where we are and here's where we're going, and these are the projections for the future of what to expect. This is what governments use to make plans, except for ours. This is what most global governments use to make plans for sea level rise, et cetera, et cetera. Well, even their worst case projections have consistently not kept the pace with reality, because in reality, things are progressing far worse and far faster than even their worst case projections. And this is because there's a very thick layer of politics within the IPCC process that countries get to kind of weigh in on the science. It's consensus science, so it always goes to the lowest common denominator. And so you have countries like the U.S. and other big fossil fuel-based countries, fossil fuel-emitting countries, that then always try to push it to the least worst case instead of what it actually is. And so this is a very, not the only, but one of the primary components why the IPCC, you know, while people say, well, even their worst case prediction for sea level rise is just 1 meter by 2100, and in reality, I have someone in my new book, Dr. Harold Wanless, University of Miami, one of the leading sea level rise experts on the planet. He says, look, let's get real about what's happening. I've been studying this my entire life, and, you know, we could see 10 feet by 2050.
Can you talk a little bit more about the feedback cycles? As Arctic sea ice melts, there's the release of methane gases, and there's a tipping point wherein we release more methane gas through that ice melting than we, you know, have so far in our man-made catastrophe here. Can you talk about those feedback cycles?
Well, yes, the one you mentioned, I think, is what's probably the most important one, and also probably the one that most people have heard about, where the Arctic sea ice, when it was pre-climate change, it reflected 95% of all the solar radiation back into space because it's white and reflective. So as it, but then as the atmosphere warms and as the oceans warm, that sea ice melts from above and below and it shrinks, thus allowing more of that solar radiation to go directly into the dark ocean and warm it further instead of being reflected back into space, which then melts it further, and so on and so on and so on. Or, you know, I think the most rudimentary way to put feedback loops, which I learned from a U.S. Geological Survey glaciologist I went out with into the field with in Montana's Glacier National Park, as he says, the more something happens, the more something happens, you know, and so it's that. And so as that sea ice retreats, the subsea permafrost in the shallow Arctic seas, which contains vast stores of methane hydrate, which is in the ice, and as that melts, that methane is released. Methane is a far more potent greenhouse gas than is CO2. It's 100 times more potent, actually, than CO2 on a 10-year time scale. And that is already being released. and there is a threat, a very real threat, and in fact, in some areas, it's already happening, where that methane is starting to be released in very, very great volumes, and there is even a threat of a immediate methane burst that could literally all come out at once, a 50 gigaton burst, which would be the CO2 equivalent of a sizable percentage of what we've emitted into the atmosphere in entirety since the beginning of the industrial age. And so we're talking about, this is the feedback, this is the last feedback loop that you want to be kicked in. But there's numerous others, you know, like with, you know, the more the melting is happening on the Western Antarctic ice sheet, you know, the parts that are floating on the ocean that are now being melted probably the quickest from the warming oceans from below. As those melt, then they retreat back onto the continent. They were acting as plugs before, kind of keeping continental ice up on the land. And then as those literally come unplugged, all that ice now is coming into the ocean, which then exacerbates sea level rise. The oceans continue to warm. That happens faster, so that means that happens more. So these are a couple of examples. And then, you know, concluding, there's dozens now of these types of feedback loops that have already been kicked in. And this is something that the well-known former NASA scientist James Hansen, the original whistleblower on climate change, back in the 80s when he was pleading the Congress, look, we must do something now. And a long time ago, he said that if we hit 1C, we are in very, very grave threat of then activating a lot of these runaway feedback loops, and then we're going to experience catastrophic climate change. And that has come to pass. We're at 1.1C now. Everything is increasing very, very rapidly along with these feedback loops and more of them being added. In fact, just in the last week, there was another study that showed that melting glaciers are actually now releasing methane in certain parts of the world. So that's yet another one. And some of the scientists I've spoken with have said they estimate there to be at least 60 feedback loops that have kicked in.
All right. So your book that has just come out, it's The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. You traveled in documented your travels and what you saw in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about where you traveled to and why you traveled there?
Yeah, this book really started back in 1995. I saw Denali up in Alaska. I fell in love with the mountain and mountains and moved up there and got into mountaineering and immediately was faced with dramatic impacts. So this was 1996. So immediately seeing how quickly glaciers were retreating, how warm it already was up there because of Arctic amplification. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and the warmer temperatures up there, and all these dramatic changes that I saw right when I moved up there. And then, of course, the longer I kept living up there and climbing in the mountains, the more dramatic these changes were and the more evident they became to me. But then the Iraq War began. I sent myself to Iraq and had that whole phase of my journalism and then wasn't able to come back into writing about climate change until around 2010, 2011. And then that's when really the seeds of this book started to sprout because things had progressed so much in that time frame that I knew that this was going to become my primary beat as a journalist and wanted to stay with it. It's the single most important story to me on the planet. And so when the idea of the book came up, I simply wanted to go to the front lines of climate change, send myself out to places like the Amazon, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, back up onto Denali and the glaciers there, to South Florida for sea level rise, to go to the places where I already knew it was happening and the most evident, and go out into the field with some of the leading experts into these places, ideally, and talk with them about what's happening. And to give people a very science-based and fact-based picture of how far along we already are, but then equally important to me to really give the reader an emotional, visceral personal experience of what it's like to go to these places. A lot of these places I've had long-term relationships with. I've been to the Great Barrier Reef back in the 90s and then going back to it a couple of years ago and witnessing the dramatic changes from coral bleaching events. Same with Denali, going back up there, seeing how dramatically the glaciers had declined, and really bringing people into that story, because I believe that the fundamental core cause of climate change is our disconnect from nature. That, you know, most people now live in cities. We don't get out into nature very much. We don't directly personally rely on it, go out and pick food and eat it, or go out to the well or the stream to get our water. So we're not really tied into nature anywhere near what we were in this country even back in the early 20th century. So I wanted to try to remind people of that. And so the book, I explore that. I get into that. And then a departure from a lot of my climate writing, which is consistently so grim because the news is so consistently grim, I really do also explore, okay, how then shall we be during this era of loss? How do we live? How do we comport ourselves now? We are in the sixth mass extinction, but we are still here. There are still these amazing, majestic parts of the planet that are still here. We are still morally obliged to do what we can. But you know, really it is an existential crisis, and I think that means we all have to start asking ourselves some pretty very important and very deep questions about our lives and what do we want to do at this moment in history on the planet.
I want to remind listeners, you are tuned to KABU, your community radio station. I'm Ani. This is Positively Revolting, and my guest this morning is Dar Jamil. And we are talking about anthropogenic climate disruption. You can give us a call at 503-231-8187 and join us this morning with your questions and comments. Please join our conversation just like Mike has done. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for a very rational and thorough approach to climate change. I appreciate your perspective, the part about nature, connecting with nature. And I continue to be bewildered that we don't talk about our relationship with animals and how we are just churning our animals into machines at this vast rate that's causing that methane that you're talking about in big ways, animal agriculture. And could you, in your travels, could you say a little bit about what you came across in animal agriculture or what you've studied? Because to me, this horror story of climate change is actually lagging behind the horror of what we're doing to animals.
Thanks very much,
Mike. That's a very important part of this story for sure. And while I'll start with, actually, there was a study that just came out literally in the last week showing that, again, and it was really on the heels of numerous other studies that have warned us of this and sounded the alarm on this and tried to underscore basically what Mike just said, which is, you know, if part of the discussion of climate change and what to do to mitigate the impacts has to include our diet, and obviously that directly includes industrial scale agriculture, cattle, methane, the consumption of meat on a mass scale. The way that we do it is a giant percentage, literally, of the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And just taking that component out alone would go a long way in mitigating the situation at this point. But I didn't directly go into that exact specific topic in the book or in some of my other journalism. Instead, I kind of approached it a bit more indirectly and focused on wildlife and biodiversity. That was one of the things that I really explored and wanted to learn more about when I went into the Amazon. I got to go to Camp 41, the probably the most famous study camp of Dr. Thomas Lovejoy's. He's known as the some people refer to him as the grandfather of biodiversity, and he's been studying down there since the mid 1960s, and has, well, at least up until this current government, has worked closely affiliated with governments in Brazil. And when I say that, I mean has had a very consistent impact on conservation of vast swaths of the Amazon and making sure it's protected and trying to work to increase governmental protections, et cetera, et cetera. That story is now obviously changing. But the importance of it, because biodiversity is a key component to life on Earth. I think most people understand this. And the rate at which we're losing species now in the sixth mass extinction, between 150 and 200 per day, and not just animals, but plants, insects, animals, etc. And that is staggering. That's 1,000 times faster than the normal background rate of species extinctions. And in the Amazon, even, it's happening there with droughts, wildfires, slashing and burning. And again, one of the biggest problems in the loss of the Amazon is industrial agriculture. And I ran into this when I was down there. The scientists said, look, what's going on? He said, you know, you guys in the U.S. and Europe eating your steaks and your hamburgers, you're responsible, you know, you're playing a big role in what's happening to the Amazon, because what's happening is industrial agriculture is going in and just bulldozing, clearing huge areas of the Amazon and putting in pastures and creating cattle farms, because that's currently like their hot money making way to farm there. And that alone, along with now the climate impacts like droughts, wildfires, et cetera, that are having such negative effect on the Amazon. And this is so important because the Amazon, again, as I think probably the majority of your listeners understand, the Amazon plays a critical role in the global climate system, where it sequesters so much carbon from the atmosphere, draws down into the trees and the vegetation and the soil there. Well, if you remove that forest and put cattle there instead, which are obviously a net emitter of greenhouse gases, with methane, and then the production and the clearing of the rainforest, and then, you know, everything that goes into creating a steak or a hamburger, not even talk about the amount of feed and water that these cattle are using, then over time, that coupled with droughts, coupled with wildfire, coupled with increasing temperatures, the Amazon is now, there have been times already where for a couple of months in a row, it's become a source of carbon. It's literally a net carbon source, releasing carbon back into the atmosphere. And that's an extremely worrisome situation.
Extremely. 503-231-8187, the number to call. If you have a question this morning or want to join in this conversation, please do. 503-231-8187. And good morning to Harvey. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hi, Lynn. And thanks, Dar, for all you're doing. It's so important. It's life and death stuff. I turned in a bit late, so I don't know if you mentioned this. First of all, I just want to say that I think Burger King is a Brazilian company. They pack the meat that services all the Burger Kings. But climate change, as you talked about, or I call it climate catastrophe, it's not just about ocean rise. It turns out that the tremendous weight on the polar caps, as the polar caps shrink, it reduces the weight, and that releases the tectonic plates. There's more movement in the Earth's tectonic plates because of reduction of weight, and that gives rise to earthquakes and volcanoes, and it turns out that in Oregon, you have the subduction zone, the Cascadia subduction zone. So it could create a earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone, which produces the biggest earthquakes in the world, and that could lead to a tsunami that could ride over the land. And so it's more than just ocean rise, and like in 2050 or whatever. This is a potential disaster in the making, and so it's really important that we change our ways so that we don't trigger a earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone.
Thanks, Harvey.
I've seen there have been a lot of studies about, and NASA's been involved even in several of these, showing that, you know, this is just a profound thing to think about, that humans have changed are changing the planet so much that we're literally causing earthquakes where, you know, so much ice is melting from Greenland and other areas in the Antarctic where literally it is causing shifts in the tectonics of the planet. Another way happened in Hurricane Harvey when it hit Houston a couple of years ago, when so much rain fell so quickly that literally in that region of Texas, the Earth's crust was depressed by 2 centimeters because of the weight of the rain. And you know, there is actually kind of a long list you could go down of other examples like that. But yeah, it's really stunning to think that that's the impact that humans are having on the planet, and that's obviously why we're in this new age called the Anthropocene.
I want to talk about the new Green Deal and the proposal that something urgently has to be done, that the U.S. needs to become a, if not a leader, at least needs to jump into the fray and do what can be done with something that some people are calling the new Green Deal really aggressive. For me, it seems like, well, it's certainly more aggressive than anything else we've seen in terms of systemically trying to make a difference and mitigate the harm. What do you think of the new Green Deal?
Well, I've not studied it in depth, but I've looked at it at least fairly closely enough to talk about it. And it's overall, I think it's an amazing package of legislation because it includes not just some very, very dramatic efforts towards mitigating climate impacts. I think the biggest one being getting completely off fossil fuels and shifting over to renewables within 10 years. It includes social justice legislation, the right to everybody to have a job, medical care, education, the right to everyone to vote in elections in an unimpeded and untampered way. I mean, it really covers a lot of amazing legislation. Personally, I feel that it could even go further regarding the climate the climate change response legislation. But that said, I think compared to everything else that is happening in this country, I think it's brilliant. And I think if anyone really has a look at it that has politics on the more progressive side, you'd be very, very much behind this. I think it's an amazing piece of legislation, not to talk about whether or not it will pass or its chances or, you know, any of that in this current paradigm in Washington, D.C., but on its face, it's the type of response that this country and others should be having to this crisis that we're in.
Thanks very much for that. Let's go ahead and talk to Linda. Let me remind people the number to call is 503-231-8187. And good morning, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I want to say thank you for the show, and I want to thank Dar for his last comments. I do think a new Green Deal is absolutely exciting to even hear it coming out of people who are actually in Congress. Mm-hmm. And if it could focus on training in things like community colleges, and especially for those who are disenfranchised or have not had the opportunities for education, I think that could make a difference in individual people's lives hugely. But what I really wanted to ask about, and I feel a little silly asking it, but what do you think, Dar, about the thing of turning off your lights, cutting your personal, I guess what I want to say is cutting your personal carbon footprint, doing things like turning off your lights when you really don't need to have them on in that bathroom or in that back pantry or in wherever you have it on, and other kinds of things like taking mass transit, walking more, bicycling more, using a hybrid car. I've noticed that all the ads on TV and even on the news, they're talking excitedly about how all of America has now turned to wanting to drive SUVs, which of course burn more fossil fuels and are in some ways less safe. I believe some of them don't have the same rules in terms of internal structure for safety that actual sedans do. But I just want to hear what you have to say, because so often from the left I hear, and I am from the left, I hear, oh, that doesn't make any difference. Individual action, that's just the, you know, the bourgeoisie pushing it on to the individuals and trying to make it your responsibility. But it seems to me that if we're really going to fight this battle, we all have to reduce our personal carbon footprint. And for me, practice helps doing that. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you, and I'll come back to that. That said, that there's 100 corporations that are responsible for 71% of all the greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. And then you factor in the U.S. military, which, on its own is the single greatest emitter of fossil fuel emissions on the planet. So those two facts alone really show that what you or I do personally is so small that it's almost irrelevant. Emphasis on almost, because and this is what I get into in my book, because I line out how utterly bleak the situation is, how far along we are, yet I personally feel morally obliged to do absolutely everything that I can. So I actually live up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. I live in a small passive and active solar house. I have my own well. I grow all my own vegetables at this point, and I'm continuing to find ways. My goal is every year to keep reducing my carbon footprint. And so I think that we're all morally obliged to do that. But to talk a little bit more about that obligation part, that, you know, one thing that I bring out in the book is how indigenous cultures talk about that, you know, they didn't have rights, they had obligations to future generations and to the earth. And so I try to take that perspective more in my life today, where say I'm 50 years old, 30, 40 years from now, a child that's born today, if I run into them when I'm 80, say, and they'll say, and I'm just going to talk what I know is what the world's probably going to look like then. There'll be no glaciers anywhere in the lower 48. A sizable percentage of all the glaciation in Western Canada has been has melted off. Probably most the majority of alpine glaciers in the world will be on the way out, very, very well on the road to being on the way out. And there'll be water crises around huge parts of the world. Parts of the earth will be literally uninhabitable because they get so hot for so long, so much of the year. And if that young person comes up to me and says, wow, you were there, you were active, you were doing your work, it was 2019, there was still some Arctic sea ice, there were still glaciers in Montana, there was, you know, all these crises, you saw them coming, but they weren't here yet, but you knew they were coming, so what did you do? And maybe this is a little bit selfish, but I just, for my own personal reasons, I want to be able to say, look, I did everything that I could, because to me it would be morally unconscionable to just say, oh, well, yeah, we knew this was happening, or at least I had an idea that this was coming, and so I just decided to go party. Like, I just decided, hey, what the hell? Let's go do whatever we want. All is lost anyway. Because, you know, it's no matter how bleak things appear, we owe it to the planet, which is, you know, where we come from. It sustains us. We are part of it. And we owe it to the planet to still do absolutely everything we can to care for it. And then the last thing that I'll throw into that mix, and I get emotional talking about this topic, because this is where we are, and I feel like our actions today do define the future. And for example, if someone's life work basically culminates in saving one insect, one type of insect species, you know, 50 years from now, when extinction is so, you know, we're so much further down that road, and that this is literally a different planet, and there's going to be hardly any wildlife, and there is on the trajectory that we're on right now. I think there's going to be several billion less humans on the planet. It's going to be a very, very hard place. If that one particular insect still exists, that could be a game changer that we just don't know about yet. Maybe it's a particular pollinator species. we just don't know. And so those are some of the reasons why I personally feel like we as individuals are absolutely fundamentally obliged to live our lives in a way as though the future depends upon it.
So, it is such a huge problem, an existential crisis for sure. It is larger than pretty much any other issue I can think of. I mean, we are talking about the end of life as we know it, and we are seeing it happen. So it's no longer this theoretical thing like in the 70s when I was in my science class and we heard about greenhouse gases and how this thing might be happening and we might need to look at it in the future. So there is the tendency to like go, wow, that's too big for me to deal with. I'm just going to party. There's also the tendency to say, wow, that's too big to deal with. I'm crushed. I'm paralyzed with despair. How do we take in the knowledge that the problem is as big as it is and not be crushed by despair?
That's another critical part of this story and this conversation. And I also write about this in the book. Mm-hmm. I think like anyone who writes about this journalistically, any of the scientists that are working on this very, very closely, doing the studies, and anyone just reading all of this or following the story, any of the listeners, I'm sure, are experiencing some level of grief and depression and, going through various parts of the five stages of grief that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross lined out. And I personally, when I really, really got into this story, I mean, I'd been writing climate change stories for quite a while. And then in 2013, I wrote a pretty intense piece for Tom Englehart's website, tomdispatch.com. It was called Are We Off the Climate Precipice? And I interviewed a bunch of scientists and talked about the possibility of human extinction. And it was a very, very solid piece. I was very proud of it, and it went very far and wide. And then in the immediate wake of that piece, I went into a deep depression for several months. I mean, my fight or flight instincts kicked in, like, run, we're in big trouble, or, I want to fight these people that are responsible, or these corporations and governments, I should say. And I struggled with that. And I was, struggled with sadness and anger and denial and, I was all over the map. And then I had to find a way to balance that. And then this book really brought that back exponentially so in my life, of going out into the field, like snorkeling over parts of the Great Barrier Reef that were just dead, just completely bleached out, that just a few years ago were completely fine. And going back up to Alaska to areas where I used to go climb, and going, there used to be glaciers that I had to traverse to get to a certain place, and those glaciers were completely gone. And the feelings that brings up, and I think all of us now have to contend with this. And that's actually, I think, a big issue, and I intend to write some stories on it soon about the psychological impacts of this and the human health impacts in the mental realm. That it's we're in a crisis, and we're all being faced with this, and the sadness of losing species, the sadness of things going extinct, the anger at those responsible, watching these people in this administration taking these high level jobs that are literally coal lobbyists or fracking lobbyists, as Trump's initial EPA head Scott Pruitt. I mean, it's maddening, and we have to all contend with this. And so now climate change is also a mental health issue, and that's the bottom line, and that's real. And I think, frankly, it's affecting all of us, because if you're really, really paying attention, your heart's getting crushed on a regular basis.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk to Barbara. Good morning, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi, Ani. Hi, Dar. I have a cold, so I'm a little off here with my voice. So you were just really addressing, Dar, the question kind of I was holding, but I'm wondering if you can talk with the listeners a bit about anything that's helping you right now, knowing this, your willingness to kind of keep inquiring in this heartbreaking work. What holds you through this process?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I would have been remiss not to touch on that, given everything we've already talked about.
Yeah.
on this program, which is so intense. And personally, I have found the most important thing to be is to consistently connect with the earth. That, you know, I'm very fortunate that I live in the woods outside of a little town, and I can go out in them and just stand in the trees when I'm overwhelmed, and I'll go out there sometimes just to weep if I'm overwhelmed by something that I'm writing about. And there's something about that that really helps me maintain perspective, and it really is as fundamental as I'll go out there really overwhelmed after reading too much intense climate news, and it's like, okay, you know, you trees, you folks, y'all are still here. So I'm still here too. If you're still here, I can still be here, you know? And then for me, it's the mountains are really my primary sanctuary. I go climbing, and that's where I get perspective, and not just to get, you know, cause I mean, we get everything literally from nature, but to give, you know, to go out there and let those places know, like, you know, I'm here and I'm doing everything that I can, and I'm with you, you know? And so it's a really mutual relationship. And then second to that, you know, I keep close company with people that really understand what's going on, and we talk about it regularly. I mean, me and a couple of really close friends have started having a few people over, on occasional Sundays to just talk about, you know, that topic. I kind of mentioned it earlier, how then shall we be, you know, and just people get to check in and talk about what's happening for them in this context. And, you know, those are really the two primary things. And, you know, these conversations with friends that really understand it, and, you know, that's seriously important for me. I mean, it's rare that a day goes by that I'm not having a pretty serious conversation with someone, you know, about what's happening and how we're doing with it.
I want to remind people that you're listening to KABU, your community radio station. It is about 8:45 in the morning, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani. My guest this morning is Dar Jamil. His latest book is The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Dar, you're going to be speaking at Powell City of Books Monday night at 7:30, yeah?
Correct.
So folks can come and hear more from you and get a copy of this book if they are so moved. It is an important work. And, you know, we are, as somebody who focuses a lot on public affairs here at KABU, I am often reading reports around climate change and how much worse things are than we thought they were just last year or 2 years ago, how the timelines are growing shorter at exactly the same time the leadership in this country withdraws from even the minimal international agreements that have existed. And so it's overwhelming. And so to be able to read about finding meaning in the wake of this disruption, in the wake of this catastrophe evolving around us that is so apparent at this time, is so very important. I really want to thank you for your work.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely. I also want to remind listeners that at 9:00, Veterans Voice Radio will be on the air. They will be, of course, dealing with matters of war and peace and the health issues and after effects of war. At 10:00, Valley Views looks at how the two-party political system thrives while freedom of choice dies. At 10:15, you can hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11:00, Radio Zine host Ken Jones talks to the authors of Formosa Moon, the story of their move from Portland to Taiwan. At 11:30, Making Contact explores safe at-home abortion options and growing movement for self-managed abortions. All of these programs are made possible by your support, dear listeners. So please become a member of KABU and click the donate button at kabu.fm. Support community radio. 503-231 8187 is the number to call to join us. Tony is next. Good morning, Tony. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm really glad you're talking about this. The last few summers when we've had this horrible smoke here in Portland and down the Rogue Valley, it has caused this distress in me, and it's hard to even talk to people about it. What I wanted to bring up, and Ani, you may have a lot to say about this too, is do you think the left's response is adequate for how serious this is? And I'm thinking all the issues that we have going on now with women's rights and, I mean, everything, shouldn't this take precedent over everything? And so, like, the Women's March, I guess, this weekend, and I think there's one in March, perhaps this should be the focus of that. I know everything is totally related. I just want to hear your response, where you think that all is.
For me, it's kind of a we're all in sort of thing, right? Because there is this, the existential crisis, right, of life on this planet continuing. That's huge. Can't imagine much that's huger, except while we're being crushed daily by the system that is oppressive and murderous, right? So I think it's kind of a both and. If you're in a marginalized community, the oppressive system is life-threatening on a daily basis. And so it's yeah, for me, it's not an either or. Dar?
I agree with you precisely that it's yes, all of the above, because, you know, if you don't have enough food to eat because you can't get work or you just got laid off, then that is your primary concern. You know, that's right. Going to outweigh doing activism about climate change. That's just one very crude example, but insert, you know, any other cause there, mm-hmm. you know. So it is all the above. It is all related. And that's another really great thing about the Green New Deal legislation, mm-hmm. is that it does its best to address all of that, you know. And it also is very cognizant of the fact that it is all completely, deeply interrelated. That said, you know, I personally have chose this topic because we're talking about the possibility of the end of all life on Earth. So it's an extremely important story, but it is all of these crises. You know, we are in an era of crisis, right, where, you know, pretty much whatever the issue is, you know, racism, sexism, climate change, go on down the full list. I mean, just about everything is in complete crisis,
right,
at this point. And I think and all of that's related, you know, all of it's driving itself. I mean, in one sense, it's one giant runaway feedback loop in that way as well. So I definitely wouldn't say, and I have in the past, before I really, I think, grew up a little bit intellectually, was, you know, felt, oh, well, climate change is the single biggest, nothing else matters. This is the only thing you have to address. This, and the reality is, like, I just had to break it down and say, look, no, I've had other points in my life where maybe a certain issue did feel way more important, because at that very moment it was for me, literally, about in my life. So mm-hmm. I think, just like you said, I agree with Yanni. I think it's all the above, but, you know, not to discount the importance of any of it, but obviously, yeah. You know, with what's happening to the planet, if the planet and if the life support systems on the planet go, then nothing else really matters.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's an all and. And we are living in a state of crisis. We are, I dare say, I don't want to say we're getting used to living in a state of crisis. The crisis has been here, and we are awake to it and living in this time. How to find that path through, how to not give in to despair or denial, how to live with this shock every day, that is really finding the meaning of our lives in this time. And I want to encourage people to check out Dar's work. We just have about 5 minutes left of the program. And so, Miguel, if you have a quick question, let's go ahead and squeeze you on the air right now. Good morning, Miguel.
Good morning. I just wanted to offer up a resource that I've been reading. It's called Hardwiring Happiness. That's Hardwiring Happiness by Rick Hansen. It really has helped me. I'm right in the middle of it. It's not about positive thinking, because that's a very temporal state. It's about taking moments out of your day to actually look at beautiful things, especially like in nature, or beautiful moments, and just reflecting on them. It's a discipline, it's a practice, just like a yoga practice or something, that can really hardwire your brain so that it's not caved in and just completely being overrun by all these negative information. So I just wanted to offer that up.
Thanks very much, Miguel. Yeah, taking time for the self-care of the soul, and taking care of your own psyche in the midst of this crisis. I mean, we are, again, in a very pivotal point, and perhaps past the turning point by some people's estimations. There's only mitigating harm as opposed to actually reversing, you know, and we can get out of this, you know. Dar, we just have a few minutes left. Your final thoughts?
I think that's Miguel's point is a great way to kind of start to wrap up this conversation, because it's for me, I mean, I guess my iteration of that is when I go out and just watch the trees sway in the wind, or go up into the mountains and take in a majestic view. It's like, hey, this is why I do my work. This is why I fight. This is why I am try to change the system and speak truth to power. It's because of this, and just really, you know, this is why fundamentally, this is why we're here. We're here to be on and of and with the earth, and appreciate her beauty, and work to serve her and all of the other beings. You know, I mean, that's my personal perspective, and I go to nature consistently and keep close with my good friends, because that's what helps me remember that, because it's so easy to forget with this deluge of horrible news that all of us are assaulted with now on a daily basis. So I think that's a really important thing to remember. You know, we have to sustain ourselves. Times are only going to keep getting more intense. It's not going to get easier as we go into the future. And so certainly taking care of ourselves and keeping the big perspective and remembering why we're in the struggle and why we're doing what we do is imperative.
Absolutely. Dar Jamal, thank you again for your work. Where can people read more of your work? How can people be in touch with you?
I'm a staff reporter at truthout.org, so I publish regularly there. I also maintain my own website, which is essentially an archive of all of my work, which is darjamal.net.
And again, on Monday night, the 21st, you will be speaking at Powell City of Books, downtown Portland, 7:30, with your new book, The End of Ice. Thank you for taking the time with us this morning.
Thanks very much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Hope to have you back again. Thanks very much. And we will be back next week talking about issues related to immigration with Immigration Counseling Services, and looking at the other kind of ICE. So back again next week. Be active. There are many things going on this weekend. Use your voice. And remember, action is the antidote to despair. So moving forward.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought, tell the world how you cast your vote.
Arts Foundation and KBOO would like to invite you to the 34th anniversary and tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., entitled We've Come This Far, Keep Alive the Dreams. On Monday, January 21st, 2019, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason Street. There'll be a host of civic leaders, choirs, the Jefferson Dancers, and of course, our own Victory Village Marketplace. Again, keep alive the dream. Monday, January 21st, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason, presented by the World Arts Foundation and broadcast live by KBOO Community Radio.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next at 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice Radio deals with matters of war and peace, health issues, and the after effect of war. At 10, Valley Views looks at how two-party political system thrives while freedom of choice dies. At 10:15 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Radio Zine host Ken Jones talks to the authors of Formosa Moon, which is the story of their move from Portland to Taiwan. At 11:30, Making Contact explores safe at-home abortion options and the growing movement for self-managed abortions. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you're not a member and you would like to become one, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice.